Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. Apologize to everyone for the delay because of long floor session. And I think we might be able to go past three because there aren't that many committee meetings today. We'll see how it goes. We're going to start with Senator Torres Ray's bill. Senate File 1503.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to go first in the agenda. I'm not feeling very well. I got a very bad cold since we were meeting every day and so late in the evening. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Senate File 1503 is a technical bill, and with me I have the Director of the Child Welfare Division with the Department of Human Services, Ms. Erin Sullivan, who will go through the bill to speak about the different provisions in the bill.
Ms. Sullivan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Erin Sullivan Sutton. I'm the Director of the Division of Child Safety and Permanency for the Department of Human Services. You have before you what appears to be a very long child welfare policy bill. This bill is long, however, there's not significant change in terms of policy that we are proposing. Session. I will go through the bill hopefully in a very quick fashion for you. The first 36 pages of the bill are purely technical. That's Article 1. Many of those technical changes have to do with the Interstate Compact for the Placement of Children and are some final changes because of some changes that were done at the federal level. The policy provisions really begin in Article 2 of the bill on page 37, and the bill establishes the framework for achieving priorities and setting direction, and really deal in a couple of primary areas. First is some language regarding the American Indian Child Welfare Initiative tribes and some work that the two tribes are interested in pursuing for their services on their reservations. There's language in here to clarify reasons for removing children from their homes and ensuring that we only place children who absolutely need to be in placement for either reasons of their own safety, the safety of others, or in order to access treatment. We also have language in here to enhance placement prevention activities and reunification efforts, as well as ensuring that children's connections with their relatives and families be maintained when they are in out-of-home care. The third main area is improving efforts to involve more fathers in child placement matters. And fourth, a number of provisions that are consistent with the Federal Fostering Connections to Success Act and increasing adoption of 2008 that was passed by Congress this past fall, and changes that will help us be in compliance with those federal requirements. I will go through each of those areas in a very brief fashion, highlighting the changes that are in the bill before you. I mentioned some changes with respect to the American Indian Child Welfare Initiative. That's Section 2 of the bill. Currently, Leech Lake and White Earth Reservation provide their own child welfare services for children on their reservations. Those two tribes are interested in conducting their local child mortality review cases if children should die that are on their caseload, as well as conducting their own mental health screening, similar to what the counties do. And those changes are found in Section 2. There are a number of sections that would clarify the reasons for removing children from their homes. They are Sections 6 through 9, 17 to 19, 21, 28, and 29. And in combination, these sections assure that children are removed from their home only when necessary to provide for the child's safety, the safety of others, or to access medically necessary treatment. There's clarification that placement should not be used simply as punishment for running away or truancy unless those other reasons are present. Social service agencies would have authority to release children from custody after an assessment and a safety plan is implemented. And finally, definitions of foster care would be aligned between the delinquency statutes and the CHIP statutes. Sections 5, 16, and 30 deal with enhancing child placement prevention and reunification efforts and clarifies that safety plans would meet reasonable efforts to prevent placement when kids can be kept safely at their home with services provided. There's also clear authority for the juvenile court to use alternative dispute resolution processes in child welfare that has previously been barred but is a tool for the court to use. There are a number of sections to ensure that family and sibling connections are maintained. There are Sections 5, 10, 11, 20, 22, 24, and 26. And here they would clarify requirements to ensure that reasonable efforts are made to place siblings together unless that would be contrary to the welfare or safety of any of the children. There would be requirements pertaining to frequent visitations between siblings when they are placed apart. This is consistent with current policy. Diligent effort requirements to identify and locate both parents and ensure that the agency responsible for the case has visitation plans with parents. Again, these are consistent with current policy, but it would align Minnesota statutes with a new federal law that was passed this past fall. There are clarification that due diligence is required to notify adult relatives when children are require foster care to assure that relatives are provided the first opportunity to, as a placement resource when that is appropriate, and information is provided to relatives about how to become a licensed foster care providers. There are a number of sections to improve efforts to involve fathers. There are sections 1, 3, 4, 10 through 15, 20, and 22. These sections would allow the Child Welfare Agency to access the parent locator, a service through child support to identify parents and establish parentage to support permanency, and also identify through these sections diligent efforts that agencies must make to locate and identify fathers, including use of genetic testing and when the father's adoption registry needs to be used and when it does not. And then there are sections, a couple of other sections with respect to meeting the new federal standards to ensure that we're meeting the child well-being needs of kids in out-of-home care. And they are sections 23, 25, and 27. This would be clarification that the out-of-home placement plan address the child's health care needs, need for educational stability, and maintaining children's health and mental health records so that those records follow the child, and assure that caseworker visits that are to occur on a monthly basis address the child's educational needs as well as the fact that the child is in fact attending school and is enrolled in school. And finally, there are plans for 17-year-olds who are preparing to transition from out-of-home care to independent living that there be intensive plans 90 days prior to the child aging out for the agency to help the child address their housing, health insurance, education, employment, and support services, which would be consistent with how we approach independent living for adolescents in care. And that's the bill summary. If there are any questions, I would be happy to take them.
Thank you. Questions from Ms. Sullivan Sutton? Got him speechless. Did you want us to make comments too, or just questions? Senator?
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chairman, if not, I would just move Senate File 1503 be recommended to pass and refer to Judiciary,
I believe.
Judiciary, yeah. Now.
Mm-hmm. On that motion, any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members. Members, next I have... Senate File 1503, and before I move that, 1509, excuse me, that was my previous bill, so now I'm 1509. Mr. Chairman, and before that, I need to move an amendment. This is a technical amendment, if there are any questions, Ms. Sessoms is with me to answer questions about the A1 amendment.
It's in the packets, I believe. Senator Torres Ray moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Again, this is another technical bill from the Department of Human Services, and with me I have the Director of Transitions to Economic Security from DHS, Ms. Ann Sessoms, to walk you through the bill.
Mr. Chair, members, there are four articles in this bill. The first article deals with child care program. Section 1 makes it clear that the child care addendum form may be used instead of making the family complete the entire child care application form if the family has already filled out an application form for other programs. Sections 2, 4, 5, and 6 align statute with implementation of our statewide automated eligibility system for child care, MEC squared. Two of these sections we reference monthly rather than quarterly payments or reporting, and I want to say that it's technical because it has been practiced for a number of years to do this monthly rather than quarterly, but we're lining up statute with practice here. Section 3 is a technical fix to say that it must be less than or equal to 67% of the state median income and not just less than 67%. And the last section in Article 1, Section 7, pertains to the school readiness connections, which in earlier statute was called school readiness service agreements. It's a small pilot that we're running in 14 sites, and the changes that are in this bill allow children who are already in the pilot sites to continue to participate if the family meets general requirements for the child care assistance program rather than different criteria that they had to meet when they came into the pilot. Article 2 is program integrity. Section 1 is a modification that allows counties to pay the state for computer system changes or enhancements if the change is not required by state or federal law, but the county wants the change or the report. Most often it's a report. Right now, the department is not allowed to charge for these things, and they would drop to the bottom of a priority list. So this would allow the counties to pay the state when they want the state to do something just for one county or two counties. Sections 2 and 3 concern judgments by operation of law. In Section 2, the overpayments for state-funded medical assistance and state-funded Minnesota care can become judgments by operation of law, and they can be handled in the same manner as overpayments for other public assistance programs. In Section 3, there's clarification that the judgments may be renewed through the administrative renewal process rather than through a court hearing process. And these procedures are practical, and they're cost savings to the counties and to the court. Article 3 of the bill deals with adult supports. Section 1 and 2 update statutory language about the GA personal needs allowance and facilities, and it's simply updating statute to reflect the current names and types of facilities that exist. The references that are being changed, those kinds of facilities no longer exist. Section 3 eliminates the need to relicense child foster care providers as adult foster care providers in order to obtain GRH funding for a disabled adult child who has turned 18. So if the child is in a foster care, turns 18, and is staying in the same facility, it used to be that they had to get relicensed as an adult facility, and now this will allow the child to stay there. I mean, if it's appropriate for the child to continue to live there. Sections 4 and 5 update the statute for a project that was authorized in 2007. And while it is in St. Cloud, it's not in Stearns County. It's in Sherburn County. Article 4 is relevant to the MFIP program. Section 1 increases the MFIP transitional standard based on the federal food support increases that are taking place April 1st in 2 days. So the federal government has, in the stimulus bill, increased the food support program, and the statute here simply lines up the increases in MFIP that are effective at the same time as the food increases. Sections 2 through 6 and Section 9 are technical fixes that align statutory language due to implementation of family stabilization services. And we're simply correcting references and removing unnecessary language in places that we didn't catch in statute last year. Section 7 adds a group of people, those 60 and older, to family stabilization services. And there is no fiscal impact because there are so few people in this category, but we're basically doing it to align the statute and make it more consistent with how we treat these individuals. Section 8 adjusts the work participation rate target for counties based on the federal caseload reduction credit. So the state has a 50% target rate, and that is can be modified by something called a caseload reduction credit. The counties in statute have a 50% target rate, and they came to the department and said, it seems reasonable that if the state's going to get credit for a caseload reduction, we ought to get credit too. So the statute gives the counties the credit for the caseload reduction credit if the state gets one. And Section 10 is a simplification that simply, well, yes, it's a simplification, I guess. It eliminates the requirement that when counties refer a participant to employment services, they don't need to include the date, time, and location of the interview on the notice that they give the participant because they don't always know this at the time they're referring the person. They'll still tell them where they need to go and the contact person, but in the larger counties particularly, they don't always have the interview set up at the date that they're making that referral. I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Questions from members of the committee? If none, I should ask if anyone in the audience wished to speak to the bill. If none, Senator...
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Torres Ray, I'd like to request this bill go to the Finance Committee.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we thought that you would request this bill.
Okay. Senator Torres Ray moves Senate File 1509 as amended be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Finance. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you,
members.
Hope
you feel better. Senator Roebling, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's my first time before you this year. I'm bringing back Senate File 1413, which we did have most of 2 years ago in 2007. And it actually went through the House and the Senate and ended up being rolled into the omnibus bill that was subsequently vetoed by the governor. And so we're coming back with some changes in it because it doesn't have a fiscal note as soon as I make an author's amendment to delete Section 14.
Senator Laurie moves to delete Section 14, put the bill in the shape the author wishes. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair and members, what the bill does is it makes the state responsible for running the background checks for family child care. And right now they run them for regular centers, but they are not doing them for the family child cares. And it also sets a flat fee that we believe is sufficient to cover the costs of the department doing that for the licensing process. We're not taking the licensing responsibility away from the counties. They still will be doing the general licensing, but they will be forwarding the information on through an online process to the state, and then they'll run the background check, similar to what they do now for foster care. And I have with me today Dolores Frisky from the Scott County Child Care Association, and she would just like to explain why the provider community is interested in this provision.
Ms. Frisky, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and committee, I'm Dolores Frisky, licensed family child care provider from Scott County, a member of the association, and also I network with leaders throughout the state of Minnesota. I would like to share with you 3 points for supporting this bill that come from the family child care community. The first point is protection of children. Protecting children by having child care workers have background checks is in the public's interest, and the child care system would be better served if this was done consistently by having all child care workers' background checks being part of the state BCA system. Tracking providers who move from one county to another will be easier. In my county, we have Le Sueur and Scott in New Prague, and when they move, they have to pay the fee again. Eventually, we'll be in a wrap-back system, and all child care providers will be part of this, and people who commit crimes that are disqualifiers to acquiring a child care license will be spotted much, much quicker. I would also like to share that our family child care is the only child related system that DHS currently licenses that is not in the system. My second point I would like to share is to implement consistency with BCA checks throughout the state of Minnesota. Consistency of fees paid from one county to the next is not a reality right now. Each background check with this bill will be $20 paid by the provider. Currently, some counties, two in the state, have us do background checks every year. Most counties do the background check in conjunction with the license, when the license is renewed, which is every 2 years. Some counties charge less than the $100 that they can currently charge. Other counties, 13 of them, charge nothing for either the license or the background checks. The background check does not relate to the number of background checks being done. And for example, a single provider who only needs herself or himself background check pays the same $100 as somebody who submits 10 or 12 background checks. The legislation would require, that you have in front of you, requires a $20 one-time fee to get into the DHS background system. And Mr. Kerber will talk about the online process. What we are looking at here, what family child care is, some of us wait in some counties in this state 6 months to get a background check processed. And in that particular period of time, they can do it in 3 days through the DHS system unless it's a complicated one. So we would like to see it for that particular reason. Family child care providers requiring additional background checks in the future when our children turn 13, when we get a new substitute helper or another caregiver coming into our system, will be paying the $20 fee for each additional one. The fees are paid online, so the counties don't have to deal with collecting fees, which would make it easier for the counties. And at this particular time, family child care providers, as I said before, we are willing to pay our own way to get this portion of the professional development system for child care in Minnesota moving forward and to collaborate in unifying a system and tracking caregivers who move from county to county or from one child care system to another. So we're willing to pay our own way on this particular one. Senator Roebling addressed that this was passed 2 years ago, which is, I think, important. We've been very patient, as we are as child care providers, waiting to come back with this again and get this system working. I did a survey across the state of Minnesota. 88% of the leaders of this state are behind this concept of paying their own way to get into the DHS system. The only opposition was the counties who get both the license free and the background check free at this particular time. My last point is has to do with the economy right now. The economic crisis of parents losing their job has a direct impact on our child care system. Many providers are experiencing lower enrollments. $100 may not seem like a lot of money to you, but when caregivers net less than the minimum wage per hour, the prepayment of these fees before the process of licensing can take place, plus the licensing fee, plus the background check fee, makes a lot of providers find this a financial burden, and they do not renew their licenses. A lot of our licensed providers have not renewed in the 5 years that we've had both the license fee and the background check. In conclusion, Family Child Care requests your consideration to let us pay our own way to be part of the DHS BCA system. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Friske. Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jerry Kerber. I'm the director of the licensing division, and I'll be very brief here. As Senator Roebling mentioned, this was passed in 07. At the same time that the department had an initiative to take over or to transfer the background study responsibilities of counties related to child foster care to the state, and that was for purposes of the Adam Walsh Background Study Act that was at a federal level, put some new responsibilities on. And so we figured out a way to do that, and what this would do was simply build on that system where the counties play some role. The counties, as you recall, do the monitoring of family child care providers, but this would use the online system where people would enter the information online. It would pass through the county onto the state, and we would conduct that background study and then provide the results electronically and through the mail in every case. And we have been able to do that within the 3 days timeline that's in statute, and oftentimes within 24 hours if somebody doesn't have a criminal history. So I can tell you that this probably could work. The main difference for us from the 07 language was that this has a $20 fee for background study. And at that time, that proposal was to fund the background studies out of the general fund. So if there are any questions, I can try
and answer. Questions for either of the witnesses. Mr. Neumeister, you wanted to speak to the bill?
Yes.
And is there anybody else in the audience who wished to speak to the bill?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as sometimes happens when I wander into a room, I look at something and speaking with Mr. Kerber, and that's what happened today. So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, I would have probably said something to you if I would have, but I'm covering a lot of bills, so I just discovered this. So I'd like to share two concerns, and maybe Mr. Kerber could illustrate this. One of the things, as you know, historically, there was a lot of things done 2 or 3 years ago, and now individual senators and some senators and reps are starting to say, did we go too far in doing some things? And you'll see individual bills coming in to make those people that may have been working or certain kinds of offenses that were brought in the wide sweeping legislation a couple years ago, some exceptions. So one of the concerns I have is if you're now going to this new on a county, are those folks going to have all the same due process that folks that are licensed now under DHS and go through those background studies? So that's the first question. And that's something I've worked with Mr. Loving, who is his Mr. Kerber's predecessor before that, to make sure there's notice, people know about what kind of information is being used against them, either to disqualify them or to challenge the accuracy of the data. But the other thing that hurts, that I have a concern about. Oh, that's gone. Okay. I see Section 14 on page 9 is gone. So that would have raised a number of red flags. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that is just my first question then. Is there due process? What is now currently will it be for the subjects that will come under this new language? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. And this bill is going to Judiciary Committee, I believe.
And, Mr. Chairman, after that it needs to come to finance. I don't think it has fees in it.
Maybe Judiciary does not need to see this. I don't know. They had requested, would it have been because of Section 14 or was it because of the data issues Mr. Neumeister raised?
It was heard in the House in their Public Safety Division, partly because of the background check information. And I do know that there are a couple of counties that have an interest in talking a little further about the fact that they feel they do a more extensive background check at the county level than what the state is providing. And so they would like to talk about it at Judiciary, I guess.
So we will keep it headed towards Judiciary because I think they did request it. Is there anybody else who wishes to speak to the bill? Senator Roebling.
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Kerber can answer some of the due process questions if you're interested in that, because there is a process that is followed if people are flagged because of the background check.
Mr. Chair and members, on the due process issue, there is no change to the due process. The system of due process that Mr. Neumeister mentioned is already in place for these background studies, and that doesn't change. The only part that changes here in this system is who does the initial background study. Currently, when the counties are doing these background studies, they're doing them under the authority and direction of Chapter 245C, as does the Commissioner of Human Services. This just changes the front end of that background study as to who gathers the criminal history information and then makes that initial disqualification decision. But after that point, all the same due process is in place.
Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I would so move that Senate File 1413 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Judiciary.
On that motion, Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebling, are these fees in the governor's budget?
Senator Berglund.
The fees that you have in this bill, are they in the governor's budget?
No, Senator Berglund, they are not in the governor's budget.
Thank you.
But members, I would remind you that there are fees that this group is voluntarily coming forward to change the system to something that they feel may be more effective for their operation.
Further discussion, if not Senator Coring, on Senator Coring's motion that the bill be passed and referred to Judiciary. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Oakland.
Thank you, members.
Senator Laurie. And for members of the committee, we are going to go on a little bit further. The only committee that's meeting after ours that I'm aware of is State and Local, which Senator Laurie and I are on. But other than that, if people are able to stay a little bit longer, we...
Mr. Chair, economic development is on my schedule for 3 o'clock, too.
Okay.
And I don't know. I think I'm the only one on there from this committee, I guess.
Let's go fast.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 1436, Sex Offender Program Provisions Modifications. I'd like to start out with a very technical, basically just wording, A1 amendment. I'd like to move that.
Senator Laurie moves the A1, you said it was?
Yeah, it's an A1 amendment that council recommended. It's really just...
On the A1 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Okay, Senate File 1436, rather than the Sex Offender Operational Changes. Section 1 modifies state procurement chapter of law by exempting the solicitation process described in this chapter, goods and services from the MSOP facilities. Section 2 essentially allows the executive director and the Office of Special Investigations to utilize unmarked vehicles. Section 3 to 5 modify MSOP definitions by adding new terms. Section 3, the term is client, and it's defined a client as a person admitted to MSOP or subject to a court hold order under Minnesota Statutes 253B-185. Which is the sexual, psychopathic personality, sexually dangerous person commitment statute. Section 4 defines the term community preparation services, which are the specialized residential services or programs operated or administered by MSOP outside the secure treatment facility in Moose Lake. Section 5 defines the term executive director. The executive director is right here, Dennis Benson. He's the person charged with the overall responsibility of the operation of MSOP. Section 6 updates the statute establishing MSOP to acknowledge the different campuses and services, treatment, and programs provided by MSOP. The current statute specifically lists just Moose Lake, and it's more pieces than that. Section 7 requires the Commissioner of Human Services to establish a sex offender treatment advisory panel to advise them on this developing treatment modality, and so it'll pull in folks from around the nation to take a look at how they're doing and give them constant feedback on how to improve the program that they're running. Subdivision 3 within Section 7 requires the executive director to establish a grievance policy and grievance procedures that address and attempt to resolve client concerns and complaints. Sections 8 and 9 change the MSOP Productive Day Program to the Vocational Work Program option in order to clarify that the work program is an extension of therapeutic treatment. This section also provides, under Subdivision 6, that the Commissioner of Human Services has the discretion to set the pay rate for clients participating in that vocational work program and has the authority to retain up to 50% of any payments made to a client participating in the program in order to reduce the state costs associated with operating MSOP. Sections 10 and 11 amend the escape from custody statute and related sentencing statute under the criminal code to expand the crime to all MSOP clients, again, not just those at Moose Lake. That's really the essence of the bill. I've got the executive director, Dennis Benson, and Dan Storkamp, the deputy director here to answer any questions.
Mr. Benson, Mr. Storkamp, did you wish to speak or just questions? Okay. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Benson or Mr. Storkamp, how much is the MSOP program collecting under the vocational work program option now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, currently we are collecting nothing. We had this language in statute, but our legal counsel found that there were some minor issues with it, so we came back this year, and there's some cleanup language in that area. So we will be beginning that process as soon as we have law here.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Benson, I was told that this program was up and running.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, the program is up and running. We are paying patients to do work, clients, but we have not withheld any of their wages thus far.
All right, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Benson, let me ask the question differently then. What is the total earnings of the program?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, I believe our estimated payroll this year is approximately $1 million.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair, I have a grammatical change.
Senator Higgins has an editing change.
On lines 6.3, delete the word comprised, insert the word composed.
On Senator,
it's fine with me.
6.3. You don't want to get, you don't want me to get into the whole comprises the parts piece, but composed will get you
That's
there.
Right. On Senator Higgins.
No, in fact, let's change it. Three members who are licensed psychologists, da 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 da, or. So delete comprised of, insert who are.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Lori, any? Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lori, on page 6, lines, I don't know, starting at the top, this advisory panel, what's the, where did that come from? And
well, that came
the goal
from,
there?
Mr. Chair, that came from, you know, we have new leadership at MSOP, and this is a, you know, a treatment modality that is developing around the country, and we want to make sure that we stay on top of how people are doing across the country. Ours was one of the earlier ones, but it is in constant need of review, and we need to make sure we stay up with national standards, and so we're going to try to pull together a team to look at how we do compared to other states and make sure that everybody's working together to make sure that we do the best we can. As you know, the per diems at the MSOP have been quite high, and we'd like to make sure that we do everything we can to run the program in as efficient and productive a manner and offer the best treatment that we can. And so this constant review process is a critical piece of helping us to make sure that we can do just that, run the best program with the best treatment modalities available.
Are there any other questions? I assume this has judiciary issues?
Yeah, there is a judiciary thing. We'll be going to judiciary.
All right, Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Lori. So, with regard to your advisory panel, and maybe it's in here somewhere else, but that's all fine and well that they're reviewing and studying and trying to do things better. Is there a mechanism in here? Oftentimes there's some way that this is communicated to the legislature,
mm-hmm.
And I'm not seeing where that is.
Senator,
but I bet Lori? It's in here. And we've had many conversations about
mm-hmm.
the need here.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch, I think Mr. Benson can help.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, certainly this will be a public document that will be accessible to the legislature. In fact, we have three members, not under this statute, obviously, but we do have three folks in the field that are coming to evaluate our program here in the next couple of weeks. So while the language doesn't call for a report, it's certainly public information and available.
Well, there is a report on lines 617 and 618, a written report of findings to the executive director and the clinical director, and that would be a public document. I suppose it could be delivered to the chairs and ranking minority members. It would likely bring us before state and local. But that's okay.
Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair and Senator Lurie, I think that is only fitting. Particularly, this is one area of our budget where the governor has asked for a 19% increase.
I'd look to council to help draft that. I mean, actually, I sit on state and local. I can probably rattle this one off pretty good.
Ms.
So
White.
It would be reported to the chair and ranking minority member of the legislative committees with jurisdiction over health, policy, and budget.
That would be it, Ms. Wright? Okay. And we'll have Ms. White do the technical thing. But any discussion on Senator Lurie's motion as he just stated it? If not, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, say no. Whoops. Adopted. Anything else on this bill? So now do we have to send it to state and local before it goes to judiciary?
No, we'll go to judiciary first.
Okay. All right. Senator Lurie moves that Senate File 1436 is amended, be recommended to pass, and go to judiciary. Any final discussion? Seeing none. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Prevails. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Moving right along, Senator Lurie has 1447.
Madam Chair and members, Senate File 1447. This is a Department of Human Services licensing bill. We'll get Jerry Kerber and Laura Plummer-Zrust here with us to help step us through. I do have a couple of author's amendments to adopt, and then we'll step through the bill. I have the A3 amendment.
That's in our packets.
Yes.
All right. Senator Lurie moves the A3 author's amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Prevails.
And the A4 amendment, which I saw was also in our packets.
All right. On the A4 amendment, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Prevails. Senator Lurie.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. With that, I will just turn it over to the department staff. There's a couple of articles, 28 sections, and we'll go through them. But for timing's sake, it's probably just better to let the department take it over.
Okay. Who's going to start? Ms. Plummer-Zrust, if I remember correctly.
Madam Chair, yes, Laura Plummer-Zrust from the Department of Human Services Licensing Division.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Go right ahead.
As Senator Lurie indicated, we are amending a number of bills here, a number of acts. Amendments to the Data Practices Act, our Human Services Licensing Act, the Human Services Background Studies Act, and then some amendments to the Reporting of Maltreatment of Minors and Vulnerable Adults Act. And I will go through this briefly. Primarily, these amendments further clarify areas of licensing statutes that we have needed to rely on interpretation, as well as further amendments to enhance the effectiveness of the department's enforcement activities. First of all, Article 1 contains the data practices provisions, Sections 1 and 2. The first section adds applicant data to the investigative data provision to clarify that investigative data on applicants is confidential. Section 2 adds further clarification regarding when specific data related to licensing actions becomes public data. Now I'll move on to the Human Services Licensing Act, and that is in Chapter 245A, Sections 1 through 10 of the bill, and I'll address author's amendments where they appear within that context. Section 1 clarifies a provision that's currently in Minnesota rules regarding an exemption for individuals who are professionally licensed and provide chemical dependency treatment services and receive no public funding. They're exempt from licensure, and this is already in the rules. Section 2 clarifies that license holders must provide licensing access to electronic records, and an author's amendment provides further clarification in that regard. Section 3 provides that the commissioner is prohibited from issuing or reissuing a license to an individual or entity if they have an outstanding debt for a license fee, a fine, or a settlement agreement. And it also clarifies that when a license is revoked, the controlling individual or license holder may not hold another license for 5 years. Section 4 is actually deleted in the author's amendment. It was redundant of another electronic record requirement. Section 5 clarifies that licensure must be denied, and it makes it consistent with the revocation provisions under Section 245A07, and also makes the appeal submission standard the same as for other licensing sanctions under 245A07. And there is an author's amendment here that is just a reformatting amendment. Section 6 is also a technical amendment, deleting the word proposed from the licensing sanctions provision. Section 7 clarifies that if a license holder submits a timely appeal of a sanction order, that it stays the order. And that is the current interpretation, just a little clarification there. The first author's amendment that is more substantive is Section 7, and that adds a new section to the bill that establishes a new license category and standards for adult foster care services that do not have a caregiver in the residence during normal sleeping hours as required under the adult foster care rules, but uses alternative overnight supervision, including electronic monitoring technology. And I do believe there are others perhaps later on who would like to address this provision of the bill. So we can, should I move forward? And
yeah,
okay. Go ahead.
All right. Section 8 clarifies the sudden infant death syndrome reduction sleeping position, clarifies that this requirement applies to newborns through 12 months of age. And there is an author's amendment in this provision as well that does two things. First of all, it adds a requirement that the parent directive already in the law that for an alternative sleeping position other than sleeping on the back. What we're doing is we're adding a form prescribed by the commissioner that will provide parents with the information about the risks of SIDS and the importance of placing infants on their back to sleep. And then also adding the requirement that infant crib mattresses must fit tightly over the mattress. And this is consistent with the American Academy of Pediatrics as well as a Consumer Product Safety Commission alert. Section 9 clarifies the authority of county licensing agencies to grant variances related to license capacity of family child care. Section 10 clarifies training requirements governing sudden infant death syndrome and shaken baby syndrome training for family child care providers. Now I'll move on to the background studies, Human Background Studies Act, and that is sections 11 through 20 of the bill. Section 11 clarifies when a new background study is needed for employees that work in seasonal programs, and that actually is deleted in the author's amendment because that's being addressed in another provision I'll get to in a moment. Now there are five author's amendments dealing with background studies law, so I'll go through those each in order. The first, adding a new section requiring amends a current section 245C04 requiring license holders to notify the commissioner when an employee returns to a program after an absence of 45 days or the program again begins to provide licensed direct contact services after 45 days. So that basically is part of the replacement of the deleted provision 11. Secondly, amendment to 245C07 clarifies that for an individual who has direct contact services in more than one program, works in multiple programs, if one program closes, then they have to have a study under an active license. The next author's amendment clarifies the juvenile record court provisions, basically making those consistent across studies that DHS requires juvenile records based on reasonable cause. And the last author's amendment in this regard amends section 245C13, this is on page 16, regarding when a notice is sent that more time is needed to conduct a study. The notice must indicate whether the individual is required to be under direct continuous supervision. Now I'm moving on to section 12 on page 16. The next group of amendments, sections 12, 13, 14, and 15, all do the same thing. They're just repeated in the respective provisions about the look-back period of disqualification. We have a permanent bar, or excuse me, a permanent 15, 10, and 7-year look-back period. So they all do the same thing, and what they're doing is clarifying the look-back period for Alford pleas.
Ms. Plummer's-Rust, I see that you're adding yet another thing to the 15-year disqualification on 18.24. So that one is different from the rest? I don't see that added in other things.
Madam Chair, yes, you are correct. With regard to the 15-year look-back that you're referencing to, in addition to what I just said about the Alford plea, we're also adding aiding and abetting. So that is the one difference, the other provisions. It's a felony level. And what aiding and abetting, we found that when we're looking, because we look at other state records when we're doing background studies on people, we've found accessory as a fact, after the fact, excuse me, in other states, laws under their criminal codes coming up, and that is not a crime in Minnesota. You know, we don't have accessory after the fact. We have aiding an offender. So it's analogous to that. So, yes, that is new.
So we've got somebody who didn't commit a crime. They just helped somebody else in the after the fact, even, and you're going to have a 15-year strike off from a job.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is right. We're adding it as a disqualification, aiding an offender. It's not a permanent disqualification. They would have a chance for the due process, of course, but it is being added to the list.
You know what? 15 years may as well just be a permanent strike off. Remind me, I'm going to have a motion to undo that. So go ahead, please.
Section 16 adds a cross-reference to the Data Practices Act. It is a technical amendment. And Section 17 on page 24 amends the permanent bar provision of our law. And what this does is it creates an exception to the permanent bar. But what the permanent bars are, that permanent disqualifications an individual, there is no discretion on the commissioner's part to set aside a disqualification. Here we are saying that for purposes of child foster care only, to provide that when a licensed child foster care provider adopts an individual who had received foster care services from the provider for over a year, and in the author's amendment that's changed to 6 months, the commissioner may grant a variance to the license holder to permit the adopted individual with the disqualification to remain affiliated with the license holder. So that can go forward. Section 18 amends a 10-year bar provision to clarify that criminal vehicular operation is a 10-year bar if it causes death. So this isn't new. This is actually scaling it back consistent with original legislative intent. That is not a bar if it resulted in injury, if it did not result in death. Section 19 specifies that for disqualifications related to child foster care, these, as was indicated here earlier this afternoon, the counties do those studies. If there's a subsequent appeal reconsideration, we will do those. And then lastly, with regarding to the human services license, background study law, Section 20 clarifies that the reconsideration decision on an ELFR plea, when that's a final agency decision. Then the fair hearing statute, there are two sections of changes there that are both technical. Sections 21 and 22 clarify that the hearing right arises from a not set aside of a disqualification, and Section 22 corrects an erroneous cross-reference. Then lastly, in terms of the provisions being amended, the reporting of maltreatment of minors and vulnerable adults law, Sections 23 to 27, beginning on page 30, Section 23 amends the definition of neglect under the Reporting of Maltreatment of Minors Act to clarify that accidental acts are not neglect, and there is a definition of accidental already in the law on page 35. Sections 24 and 26 are identical, one with regard to minors, one with regard to vulnerable adults. And basically what this is doing is saying that the mitigating factors do not apply. When maltreatment is determined to have been committed by the license holder, then the license holder, the disqualification, and license sanction provisions apply. Section 25 on page 37 clarifies that when a child protection investigation involves a child foster care setting, child protection agencies must also notify the private licensing agency. Section 27 clarifies the name of the reporter of maltreatment remains confidential after the assessment or investigation is completed. Section 28 is a technical changes the lead agency designation from the Department of Human Services to the Department of Health for ICFMR facilities to comply with a newly federally asserted regulation. And then there are two authors' amendments in conclusion. The first, page 43, is the repealer, and this is repealing a fee provision, 245C.10, that is obsolete. This provision right now that states no applicant license holder or individual who is the subject of a study shall be required to pay a fee, and the subsequent provisions state when a fee is required, so it's no longer necessary. And then lastly, we have Article 3 is a technical amendment, and what this is doing is inserting, it's a citation technical amendment, inserting a paragraph A, because there are a number of provisions throughout Chapter 245C that go from the subdivision to the clause. Are there any questions?
Any questions on this part? Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair, I'm Jerry Kerber from the Department of Human Services, and I'll just be here to answer questions.
Answer any questions. Well, I have. Oh, go ahead, Senator Dahl.
Well, Madam Chair, first I do not know what the Elford plea is. So, if someone could explain that to me, please.
Madam Chair.
It's Plumber's Rust.
Madam Chair, Senator Dole, an Elford plea is a plea, a criminal court plea, and the individual enters this plea stating they do not enter a plea of guilt, they do not admit guilt, but they admit that there's enough evidence to convict them if it were to proceed to trial.
Okay.
So it's an admission in that sense.
Okay. Admission, but not an admission. And, Madam Chair, when it's appropriate, I have an amendment as well.
I send it back over to Senator Marty.
Mr. Dahl, you can go ahead with your amendment right now if you wish.
I do have the A5 amendment, and I don't know if that's been passed out or not.
While it's being distributed, why don't you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I'm asking, I guess, your permission to amend this to the bill. I've talked to the author, and he can speak for himself on it. I guess he wants to talk a little bit about it. There's a bill that we actually heard the other day, and it seems appropriate that we might be able to put it in the licensing bill, the child care provisions. This is on notification procedures. If someone is investigated by the department and found to have a set-aside and wanted to amend this to this particular bill.
Further discussion on the Dahl amendment?
I still don't have this. I don't have it still. Senator Dahl did talk to me about that a little bit, and it was here. It passed with a recommendation to pass and did meet committee deadlines then. And it passed with my full support. It is a policy that I think would be a good one to get in. And I guess I'll let the agency... is here. They're part of the executive branch. I'll let them speak to anything that the executive branch might think about whether this... It's definitely germane. It's a policy that I personally support. Whether it creates any additional concerns or not, I'll let the agency speak to.
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, this, if I just take a quick look... This is looks like the same exact language as the past, and we were involved with this, and when I spoke about it in the committee the other day, we talked about that this is kind of moving back a little bit from some of the pretty dramatic changes that were made in the 05 session regarding background studies and notices that are provided to people. So this was not part of the governor's initiative in 05, and it wasn't the department initiative in 05 that resulted in this. It certainly fits in with this part of our licensing bill, to be sure, and whether, I think the department probably is neutral on this issue.
Okay.
Further discussion on the Dahl amendment. If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair.
Further discussion on the bill. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Plummer's Rust, explain to me, please, what... having these, I see that you've added the criminal vehicular operation causing death to the 10-year bar, and then we talked for a minute about the aiding the offender to the 15-year bar. What do these two have to do with providing services to people in the human services work?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the first one, I'll deal with the criminal vehicular operation causing death. That is currently under the 10-year bar, criminal vehicular homicide and injury. The citation to 60921 is cited. That's current law. We're not adding that. Really what we're doing is, in essence, scaling that back consistent with what was the original legislative intent. Under the law, the criminal code has changed. There is a provision for death and substantial bodily injury, and so we're saying that it is not a bar unless it resulted in death.
Okay.
So that is not new.
So a few lines down there, what jumps out at me is you've got rioting as a 10-year bar. What possesses us to do this? At some point, we need to have a list that makes a difference in the provision of the job that has to be done, not just a list of a bunch of, pardon me for I almost cussed there, I was going to say felonies, but I see we don't, some of these aren't even felonies, so you can't even say that. And 18.24, adding aiding an offender after the fact, that's got nothing to do with whether you are a good care provider in a nursing home or in anything else. We really, at some point, Mr. Chair, need to take a good, long, hard list, or look at this list, because I think we've gone around the bend on this list. Mr. Chair, I'm going to move to delete the new language on 18.24.
Senator Higgins moves to delete the new language on page 18, line 24. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Kerber.
Just one comment. And Senator Higgins, the issue that I recall that brought this to the forefront in our office anyway was a case where an individual helped somebody after they had murdered an individual to stuff the body into the trunk for disposal. And because it was after the fact, it wasn't a disqualifying characteristic. That wasn't really aiding and abetting. It was aiding an offender. So,
but Mr. Kerber, it's a 15-year disqualification. That's the same thing as a bar in the real world.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, it's a 15-year bar, our 15-year disqualification, but it's not one of those bars. I mean, you know, we've talked many times about the permanent look back that are also the permanent bars. This is not a permanent look back crime, so it's not a permanent bar. There is no restriction in this case on the commissioner's discretion to grant a set aside or a variance for those people who can demonstrate that they don't pose a risk of harm or whose employer would like to go to bat for them and enter the little contract that we set up with a variance. So it isn't that permanent disqualification that we've had a lot of discussion about.
Maybe not technically, Mr. Kerber, Mr.
It's
Chair, but in the real world, it's the same thing. I don't know how we ever get to looking at each one of these items through the lens of the job that is being done. But, and Mr. Chair, you've heard me talk about the fact that when I started here 12 years ago, we had fewer than 4,000 people in prison. We have 9,400 people in our prisons now and 147,000 who are out in community corrections. That's ridiculous. And the fact that not only are they at that point that when they finally get done serving their time for their crimes, then they can't get a blasted job in this state either. So, you know, we've put ourselves in this terrible cycle, and I'm just going to do my one small part right here on page 18 to get rid of one piece of it. So I moved that deletion of the new language.
And Poverty Commission spent a lot of time on talking about how we make people suffer their entire life without a chance for a decent job because of a former problem. On Senator Higgins' motion to delete the new language on line 24, Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, I think you are making some very good points, and I'm going to support your amendment. Which jurisdiction, where does the conversation take place? Does it happen in this division? Does it happen in where does that happen? We need to stop this train. So where does that take place? I don't know.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Lynch, I believe these are human services provisions, so they would be here. Maybe a working group over the summer might be a good place to start. You know, once again, it's hard to look at this list and say, the item on line 15 of page 20 is should be out or in. You know, I see rioting, something about owning a... What was this one that set me off? Owning a spring gun. Okay, if we take that out of the list, does that mean people who have these kinds of guns can go do this? You know, it's a kind of a twisted conversation that we're going to have, but we're going to have it. and I think it's long overdue. But maybe we put together a group who can put some common sense together in this list. And I bet Mr. Kerber and Ms. Plummer-Strust would be part of that.
Ms. Plummer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, I did just want to add, with regard to looking at the program settings, that's a very good point, and we certainly do agree with that. And the law does provide for at the reconsideration stage, but I understand it is a disqualification. But then when we review the record, when they request reconsideration, indeed that is a very important factor that we do look at for the setting that they're working in, the vulnerability of the clients that we're working that they're working with. So we do consider that factor, at the second point in the process, essentially.
And Mr. Chair, that actually brings up this point on this, the Alford plea. So they're not pleading guilty; they're pleading to no contest or something. But now we're still making it a disqualification factor. Did I understand that right,
Madam, Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins? And that has been in the law. The Alford plea has been in the law. What we're doing this year is just clarifying the look-back period for that. But the way it operated before it was in the law is that those were looked at under a preponderance of evidence standard, and indeed the individual has admitted that there is enough evidence to convict them if the case goes to trial. So basically that automatically met the preponderance of evidence standard. The individual is admitting that there's enough evidence there.
Okay, on my amendment, Mr. Chair.
On the Higgins amendment, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
That is a good point, Senator Higgins, that we should be going through those lists. There are lots of places where we do that. I think we should keep in mind there is an entire chapter in statutes that says it's our goal to put people back to work after reintegrate them into the community, and everything we've done since that was passed is been against that chapter. Further discussion on Senate File 1447. If not, Senator Lori, move Senate File 1447 as amended, be recommended to pass and go to the Judiciary Committee. On that motion,
get to harangue about it again. Excellent.
Yes.
We'll have a high on.
Then you'll find some more things. You'll find some more things.
I'll get rid of rioting that.
Senator Higgins, I thought the obtain a signature under false pretense. I think a lot of kids, school kids, did that with their report cards.
Report cards.
Oh, this
report
is nothing.
Fraud.
Huh?
Yes, love it.
On Senator Lori's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.
Bye. Okay, Senator Marty has 1887 before us.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate File 1887 is sort of a cleanup bill related to health care agents.
Would you start by defining a health care agent?
Health care agents are defined in Chapter 145C, which is the health care directives law. And so when you fill out a health care directive, you give somebody power of attorney to make health care, you may give somebody power of attorney to make health care decisions. And we've already given them lots of power and notice and authority. That's what the point of appointing somebody like that is. However, there are lots of places where we've neglected to give them the proper authority. And this bill is a collection of what we hope is the remaining areas where it's missing. And these are areas where a person should have right to notice or access to related to a patient. For example, the first one is that directory information about an emergency patient who's unable to communicate cannot be released until a reasonable effort is made to notify next of kin, we're saying, or a healthcare agent. And it's basically just a collection of minor provisions like that that we're trying to clean up in the law. Again, if I pick somebody to be my healthcare agent, I do that because I want them to be able to make decisions, and obviously I want them to know when the facility I'm living in is having some significant changes or when they're discharging me, things that you want your loved ones to know about, you'd want your healthcare agent to as well. And that may be your primary loved one in many cases is, I suppose. Anyway, I'm happy to stand for a question. We have Phil Duran from Out Front Minnesota here to answer questions as well, and maybe he wishes to speak about it too. It's an exciting bill.
Very much so. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Phil Duran. I'm the staff attorney at Outfront Minnesota. As you may know, we are the largest organization in Minnesota working for equality for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender folks. And in my job, I get a number of inquiries. I mean, they are regularly coming in from people who are very, very concerned about what might happen to them if they end up in a healthcare setting. Where the provider has certain provisions or rules or policies that provide access or information to family members, and they say, but here this person who is as family member as they can possibly get, this is the person that I want at my side making decisions up to and including ultimate decisions. They may not have access to me. They may not be told where I am. The bill in front of you makes a tremendous leap forward, I think, in addressing some of these critical kinds of situations. They don't expand these protections at the expense of anybody else, but rather adds healthcare agents whom individuals have already designated to play this role through a legal process under Chapter 145C to continue this. It advances Minnesota's strong public policy in favor of empowering individuals and the people around them to participate meaningfully and appropriately in the healthcare treatment procedure and program. We strongly hope that this committee will support this bill.
Thanks, Mr. Duran. Are there questions from the committee? Seeing none, Senator Marty moves.
Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 1887 be recommended to pass, and I don't think this has to go to any other committees.
I wouldn't think so.
It does not, apparently.
Ms. Kavanaugh, do you know?
Well, if somebody wants it,
Senate
I'm
Council,
sure they'll
so
find a way.
We're good. Okay, on Senator Marty's motion. Any more discussion? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Adopted. Thank you, Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We actually would have, if people are willing to stay around for about 15 more minutes, Senator Erickson Ropes and Senator Mary Olson went to Canada last fall looking at their health care system, taking a quick look at it. And they wanted to make, and I asked them if they'd make a brief presentation on it, and I think Senator Erickson Ropes suggested that we first watch a 5-6 minute film clip from Frontline, not about Canada actually, but about Taiwan and how they put together their healthcare system. And because we've been looking at a number of these issues for the last number of months and will be continuing to in the next few years, I would love to encourage the members of the committee, the large number of us that are here, stay around for a few minutes to see this and hear from Senator Erickson Ropes and Mary Olson, assuming they're going to be here in 1 minute. So with that, Madam Chair, we'll turn it over for an 8 minute or 7 minute film clip on Taiwan.
Taiwanese healthcare was even worse than America's is today. About half the population had no coverage at all. Hong Jen Chung was one of the officials charged with designing a new healthcare system from scratch.
Taiwan is a small island. We always look abroad internationally for ideas. Chinese saying, we say the track of the previous card is the teacher of the following card.
So if the other guy's ox cart has found a good route to universal health coverage, follow those tracks.
Follow those tracks. If they were trapped in the trouble, avoid that track. Find a new track.
So they consulted experts from around the world and asked William Shao, a Chinese-born Harvard health economist, to head a blue ribbon panel.
Why do you want to repeat the mistakes other people make? You want to pick up what people have done well, and then move beyond that.
Another expert they consulted was Taiwanese-American health economist Chung Mei Ching.
How many different countries did they look at, do you know?
Over 10, maybe 10, 13, 15 countries they looked at.
And so in the end, the program that they finally set up in 1995 really is like a car that was made of different parts imported from overseas, but manufactured domestically.
We examined quite extensively the major systems, quite a dozen, Europe, British, or France, Germany, the Nordic countries, Swedes, the Dutch.
Well, did you look at the richest country in the world, the United States?
Yes. It was the best system in the world, we thought.
Yeah, you thought, and when you studied it, what did you find?
Well, American is not really a system that you can copy. It's a market. So if you let things happen, it will be like the United States. There are many supporters, but in the end we said, no, this is not the way we want to go.
They wanted a system that gave everybody equal access to health care, free choice of doctors with no waiting time, and a system that encouraged lots of competition among medical providers. To finance the scheme, they chose a national insurance system that forced everybody to join in and pay. But Professor Hsiao thought Taiwan could improve on other countries like Japan and Germany.
And we try to correct their mistakes. Japan has many funds.
Yes.
And we unified it. Germany let the rich people opt out. We did not let the rich people opt out. So we're building on what they have done correctly, but trying to overcome their deficiencies.
The solution? To have one government insurer collecting the money and no chance to opt out. The result? A system that works a bit like the U.S. Medicare system for the elderly, and in fact, a lot like Canada's.
It has drug benefits, vision care, traditional Chinese medicine, kidney dialysis, inpatient care, outpatient care, just about everything under the sun.
And to satisfy the patients in Taiwan, there's no gatekeeper and no waiting time. Clinics are open on weekends. This street clinic was bustling at 5:30 on a Saturday afternoon.
If I woke up in Taiwan some morning and my shoulder's really hurting, how long would it take me to see an orthopedic specialist?
We'll go now.
This morning I could see one?
Yeah.
I don't have to go to a GP and get a recommendation?
No, our people don't like the idea of gatekeepers. They want to keep themselves. They want to decide by themselves.
High-Tech Taiwan designed its new health system using state-of-the-art information technology. Everybody here has to have a smart card like this to go to the doctor. The doc puts it in a reader, and the patient's history, medications, etc., all show up on the screen. And then the bill goes directly to the government insurance office and is paid automatically. So Taiwan has the lowest administrative costs in the world, less than 2%. Compare that to the endless paperwork and all the denied claims we get with for-profit U.S. health insurance. The smart card can also be used in other ways.
If a patient goes to see a doctor or hospital over 20 times a month or 50 times in a 3-month period, then the IT picks that person out and then gets a visit from the government, the Bureau of National Health Insurance, and they have a little chat. And this works very well.
That may be too much like Big Brother to get by in the U.S., but surveys show that Taiwanese are highly satisfied with their health care.
How many people in Taiwan every year go bankrupt because of medical bills?
None.
So the patients are safe from bankruptcy, but just like Japan, the system itself is under strain.
How much of the Taiwan's GDP are you spending on healthcare
we
now?
We spend some 6.23%.
And do you know the number in America?
Yes,
what percent?
It's about 15%.
16%, that's right.
So we spend too much on healthcare and don't even cover everybody. But the Taiwanese spend too little, less even than Japan. They just don't bring in enough money to pay for all the services they offer.
So actually, as we speak, the government is borrowing from banks to pay what there isn't enough to pay the providers.
Taiwan's politicians are reluctant to increase premiums. They think voters will punish them. So that's their problem. They know the solution is fairly straightforward. Increase the spending a little to maybe 8% of GDP. Now there's a problem the U.S. would love to have. Like the other countries we've seen, Taiwan is struggling to balance the hopes of patients and the expectations of doctors against the price people are willing to pay for health care. Before leaving Taiwan, I tried some acupuncture for my bum shoulder. I heard it years ago in the Navy. Of course, Chinese medicine is covered by Taiwan's plan, too. Taiwan's achievement got me thinking about what it takes to carry out healthcare reform. But to create a universal health system in an emerging Asian nation is one thing. To get there in a mature free market economy is something else. So my final stop was in a country more like us that did take on healthcare reform.
And committee members, I just checked, and Senator Erickson Ropes and Senator Olson are presenting a bill in...
No, she's right there.
Senator Olson is not. You were in the committee, I was told, with her. If you wish to start, Senator Erickson Ropes said she would be a few minutes, that she's presenting a bill up in, I'm not sure what committee, but her staff said she was.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. She's actually up in Economic Development, the committee I sit on.
Oh, okay.
And I told her that I would get started so we wouldn't hold up the committee, and she'll join us as quickly as she can. And in the meantime, I have some information that I don't have copies for everyone, but this is just information of a few of the places we visited in Canada that I thought maybe I could just pass around for people to take a look at and then circulate it back to me again. These. And then I think Senator Erickson Ropes have these where you can all keep one.
Welcome to the committee, and I heard very little, but about a little bit about your trip. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. First, I'd just like to thank Senator Erickson Ropes for giving me a call last summer and saying, you know, we've talked a lot about healthcare reform. Senator Erickson Ropes and I co-chaired a committee that looked at putting together a statewide pool. And we were both on different committees, the single-payer working group of the task force. I also co-chaired another one of the working groups. And she said, you know, there's an example of this system just a few miles north of us. Why don't we drive up there and take a look for ourselves? And just kind of find out for ourselves, because we hear so many conflicting reports about what people think about their system of healthcare in Canada, what works, what doesn't work, and really how is it structured. So we had we made contact with the provincial officials in both Ontario and Manitoba because we knew that the Canadian healthcare system mandates a form of single-payer healthcare. It also allows the various provinces to administer the plan, and that we knew that there were differences between provinces. And so we thought, well, we'll check out a couple of them. So we went to Thunder Bay, Ontario, and we went to Winnipeg, Manitoba, spent a total of, I guess, about 5 days on our trip because we ended back at Bemidji Regional Hospital, where we had a meeting with healthcare professionals to kind of debrief and take some questions about our trip. So I should also acknowledge the officials in Canada. I have to say that I don't think we could have been treated any better than we were by the Canadian governmental officials when we were in Thunder Bay. They set up because that isn't the capital of the province. They set up a phone conference with us with about 15 of their healthcare experts and government officials who were on the other end of a phone conference with us. And then when we were in Winnipeg, we actually met with the Minister of Health And I think you might find it interesting that they also have a Minister of Healthy Living. So they have two different departments, one for health and one for healthy living, that focuses specifically on prevention. So we've got to meet with both of those ministers. And in both places, we were given not just an overview of their system and how it works. We met with, they have some innovative new reform proposals that are a little different in each province, and we got to hear about those. Then we got to take tours of healthcare facilities. We toured some of their state-of-the-art facilities in both Winnipeg and Thunder Bay, their hospitals. But then we also went on our way back from Winnipeg to a very rural community hospital to see how that hospital clinic setting was being handled in Canada. So that's just kind of the big picture overview of the kinds of things that we were able to see and do while we were there. I think what I'd like to begin by talking about are some of the differences or just kind of a general outline of how the healthcare system works in Canada. In Canada, healthcare is paid based on income, just sort of like we collect taxes in the United States. There's an income-based system nationally for collecting the funds that are used to fund the healthcare system, and then then those funds are redistributed back out to the provinces for the application with the medical community and hospitals. Each individual province has some differences as well in terms of some things they might add on to what the national health care plan provides. And so there might be some provincial taxes if there was something that a particular province decided to pay for that wasn't included with the national health plan. The health plan coverage is very comprehensive. So there's from preventive care to general medical care, family types of care, as well as hospital care. And there isn't a limit in terms like we have with our insurance today. So everything is covered. A couple of the exceptions to that rule are that dental care is not covered under Canada's system. It's generally something that is a benefit through an employer in Canada. And long-term nursing home care is covered, but there is an expectation, depending on income, that a person will contribute something toward the cost of their long-term care, so it's graduated based on income. However, if a person paid for long-term care, or I should say if the province paid for long-term care based on this income scale, there's no lien that would attach to a person's estate where they would expect repayment after the person's death. In fact, when we asked about that by comparison, they looked at us like, what are you talking about? They didn't I guess that concept had never occurred to them that the government would come back after a low-income person's estate because they received care for something that was needed. So they don't do that there. A big misconception that people have about Canadian healthcare is that it's some kind of a government-run healthcare system. And that's really not true. It's a government-reimbursed healthcare system, but the hospitals, the hospitals for the most part, and the physicians are private. And a person has a complete choice in terms of where they want to go for their care and who they want to use as their physician. Reimbursements are negotiated kind of like the insurance companies negotiate now with our healthcare systems, except in this case the doctors have, through their medical college, acts almost like a union on their behalf and negotiates the rates for a particular procedure. I think it was on an annual basis with the government. That helps the government have some impact on being able to pay for the things that are proven to be medically helpful types of procedures, because the government has a very simple way to encourage what are considered to be best medical practices by how those things are reimbursed, as opposed to things that are not particularly helpful from a medical standpoint. And by the same token, the government because they are negotiating directly with the healthcare providers and the hospitals, if there's a need for a doctor in a particular underserved area, if there's a need for a healthcare facility in a particularly underserved area, the government has the ability to increase the reimbursement rates to make sure that the care is available in those areas. There is no managed healthcare per se in Canada. In other words, there's no requirement for pre-approval. Once again, when we asked about that, we first kind of got met with a blank look, and then we had to explain what we were talking about, and they said, why would some other third party be able to second-guess a decision made between a doctor and the patient? And we said, well, good question, but that's what we do in the United States. Well, that's not what they do in Canada. The doctor and the patient make decisions about patient care, and there isn't a third party that someone has to go through to get approval. Of course, because everyone is covered, there's no money that's spent on rating people for pre-existing conditions. Everyone is covered. No one is excluded. And all of this occurs for about half the cost. On average, of what we pay in the United States per capita for our health care. The charges for services in Canada are much lower than they are in the United States. So a typical hospital stay, a typical clinic visit, medication is all much less expensive in Canada, which is probably why a lot of people up north in northern Minnesota, where I live, actually go across the border for some of the services, because even if they're not covered by their insurance company, it's still less expensive to go there than to have the services and have the application of deductibles and copays in the United States. The concept, I think, as I said before, what I was going to say is, though, even though care is much less expensive in Canada, so the cost of paying for that care is less expensive, we actually found that because of the negotiation process, that hospitals are not ever in a situation where they're having to operate at a deficit like some of our nursing homes are in this country, and actually some of our hospitals are now being threatened with. And the doctors are paid fairly well, comparatively, especially family practice physicians, because they're paid on a fee-for-service basis for the most part. There's an incentive for them to treat people, and they actually are making, don't want to be quoted on the exact number because there was quite a range, but depending on where we were, family physicians were making from $200 to as much as $500,000, so they weren't being underpaid in comparison to, say, standards in this country.
Senator Dell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, you mentioned you have Minnesotans going across the border because it's the services are cheaper in general. Is there something that precludes a health plan from actually contracting with services in Canada to get some services and pay for them directly? I mean, we outsource different services, but the companies overseas, other companies. Why is there something in our law or between countries that we health plan could not do that? Do we know?
Mr. Chair, Sarah Dahl, you know, I don't know. I think a lot of plans in this country will pay if you're on vacation. You know, it depends on how your plan is written. I can probably speak to that more in reverse than, for example, I know that in Canada, if a Canadian were visiting this country and had a need for medical care, the government will pay, reimburse, but only up to the amount that that would have been paid if they had been in the Canadian system. So a lot of times what Canadians will do is take out separate insurance. The unfortunate thing We heard a story from one lady in at the hospital that we visited in Thunder Bay, and we were asking people wherever we went kind of to share their healthcare stories and what they thought of their healthcare system. And this lady said she'd visited Florida, and she was there, I think, for about a month. And so she said she paid around $1,000 for a health care policy that would cover her during the time she was in Florida. While she was there, she got pneumonia and was in the hospital for a week. She was denied coverage by the health insurance policy because she'd had lung cancer in the past. So they said because her pneumonia was in her lungs and she'd had lung cancer, that was a pre-existing condition, and they wouldn't cover it. So when she got back to Canada, because Canadian health care bill would, because the bill would have been so much less under the Canadian system, she still ended up having to pay out of her own pocket about $17,000. So she said, I don't think I can afford, you know, your health care in your country, or even just, you know, taking the chance of visiting our country again and potentially getting sick here. So that was her story. But in terms of in reverse, I'm not sure if our health insurance policies typically would cover health care that someone would receive in Canada. But that's a good question.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I'm just thinking if you were closer, you know, geographically to, say, Winnipeg than Duluth, and you needed a service where you'd have to drive to, say, Duluth for that, but it was $1,000 cheaper in Winnipeg, why wouldn't the health plan just pay for the service to go there? I don't know. I mean, it's something that's in law or statute that says they can't. I'm just a thought as you were explaining mm-hmm. this stuff out. So,
and Senator Dahl and Senator Oaks, I think because Senator Erickson Ropes isn't here, and because how late it is, maybe we should continue this discussion sometime when she and you both can. I wanted to say I was looking through your book. It's Thunder Bay Regional Health Center, the hospital, apparently. I was trying to find out what they charge for things. The only thing I could see they charge for is television use in your room. I was going to say that here that's one of the – they do have parking as well, but it seems strange here that while they do charge for parking, the one thing you get free here is television. It's the health care that's so expensive here. But interesting. I would like it if you would be willing to come back with Senator Erickson Ropes when she's not presenting a bill up and when it's not so late in the day.
Sure.
You were there for about a week, you said?
Mr. Chair, we were there. Our trip total was about 5 days. We were there about 2 days in each location.
And the back of this one thing you handed us, too, it had wait times. Maybe we can go into that sometime next time when you finish up. This was from Sharon. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can have her look at this mm-hmm. when we go to.
Mr. Chair, one other thing that I'll bring up that I thought was particularly compelling, a couple of components. Just one is that there's a requirement for public meetings and feedback regarding the healthcare system, so that has to happen routinely in terms of making adjustments. The other thing that I thought was very interested in Winnipeg is that there are community facilities where what we would consider social services or things that fall under health and human services, whether it's food assistance, whether it's testing children for certain things, whether it's just a whole host of community types of services, are provided in the same building as family health care services. So it's kind of a one-stop shop for the kinds of things that a family might need. That kind of model is maybe somewhat like the idea of a health care home in terms of making sure that there's some continuity between services and that we don't have those artificial boundaries that we draw in this country. And then the final thing I'll say, just in case we're not back, don't have time to come back again, is that some of these people who we met with in Canada would be happy to come down if we ever wanted to have a more detailed discussion with them, or if we ever wanted to take a trip as a group or your committee did, they would be very happy to host you.
Thank you. It sounds like they treated you well. They call you an international delegation.
I know.
And I do like this Minister of Healthy Living. I think we really could spend more time on prevention, too. With that, why don't we wait until we have a chance with Senator Erickson Ropes as well, and Senator Dowell, one last question.
If I might, just a couple suggestions, Mr. Chair. Well, this, I don't know if you were going to go through this particular presentation or not or talk about it. If there's some way we might have someone that could on this integrating local health integration network with the Ministry of Health and how those two function together. I think it might, it's going through this, it sounds like it's something that we should probably know some more about on how they operate. And then I would, my suggestion would also be maybe we could have this meeting at a time where it's maybe at the beginning of a session or meeting instead of at the end, so we retain more of our members. So
that's thank it. You.
Thank you very much for having this opportunity, Mr. Chair.
And we look forward to continuing the discussion. With that, this meeting is adjourned.